Minneapolis, on September 3, 2006. This talk may not be played or reproduced for profit.
Good morning. Good to see you all today. I hope you had a good summer. Is this kind of the official end or tomorrow? Not the actual end, right? But summer's coming to a close, you know. Well, this summer, my wife Jean and I, we went to the Boundary Waters as we usually do. And I was kind of taken this time, though I've heard it over and over and over again. When you go to the Boundary Waters, you have to go to the ranger station and then they play a film for you that I could almost recite for you, I think. I've seen it so many times. Still, we have to view it, which is good. It's around these three little words, leave no trace. And I don't know, this time around, I think maybe it kind of hit me. When we got into the wilderness, as we were leaving the landing, some people were coming in, and I just asked them, hey, you know, if any campsites that are open out there, you know. We were going out onto a relatively large lake that had a lot of campsites. And so they told us where they had been. And they said the campsite was open. So I thought, well, let's just check that out. It was up kind of in the area where we wanted to go. So we headed up that way. And sure enough, the campsite was open. And just landing at the campsite, I started to get out of the canoe. And I just noticed there was a few fish entrails there right on a rock. Well, you see that once in a while. I didn't think too much of it other than, you know, they really should take care of that. You shouldn't leave that there. But as we went in, decided we were going to set up there, I was unloading the canoe a bit, and then Gene was going around and checking out the campsite. And there's some trails that went off. We'd paddled by that place many times and kind of knew that off to this one side there were some huge rocks that went down into the lake. Beautiful place for swimming. It's a nice swimming hole there. And she had gone off in that direction and later came back and told me when she was then she brought me over to see for myself. As she was approaching the edge of the water where the rocks opened up, the edge of the trees, she could see through the trees, suddenly this huge vulture took off. And when she got out there, here was all these fish remains all over the rocks. Well, she brought me over to look at it. Me thinking, leave no trace, you know, leave no trace. And here's all these fish remains. And I walked over to another spot along the shore there. More fish remains. And got up on the rocks and looked down in the water. Here in places in the water, all kinds of fish remains. And I thought, you know, these people actually told us that we go to this site, this is where they were. No shame. No consideration for what anybody else coming along behind would find. No remembrance of the rule to leave no trace. Well, we cleaned up the remains, and it turned out that we had to haul them off in two different directions because there was so much. We had a fairly large plastic bag that we used to scoop them all up. They're mostly walleye, I think, and the heads and tails and guts and all of that. And in some cases, whole fillets were still just sitting there. We filled up one big plastic bag, hauled that off, then we came back, filled up another. Had to get down in the water to get all the stuff out. The reason they want you to remove that, you're supposed to take the fish remains, take them back 150 feet, if I have that rule memorized. Eh? You never fish though, so. But you take them back 150 feet from the shore and bury them. And the reason they want them buried is so that the birds won't come in. The seagulls are kind of taking over. People leave their fish around, fish remains on the shore, and the seagulls will come in. and the seagulls are crowding out the loons. So it's really destabilizing the balance up there. And so they want us to be good stewards, good campers. When we leave our campsite, we leave it as clean as we found it, or cleaner. Well, in this particular case, that isn't what we found. We found enough remains to actually fill a big shopping bag, if you can imagine, full of rotting parts of fish. Well, I just wanted to say something about that, because I think it's part of our practice here that we leave no trace. It's certainly easy for us to forget this. These people, since we met them, didn't know who they were, but like I said, they had no sense of shame or guilt or that they've done anything wrong. In a sense, maybe kind of innocent, but not really innocent, more ignorant and inconsiderate. Even if they weren't aware of the ecological disturbances and things that this could create, they weren't even thinking of the other people coming along behind. Within a few days, I've been at other campsites where fish have maybe sat there for a day or two, and they begin to really stink if you don't remove them. In fact, as it was, the next day after we had it all cleaned up, but in spite of that, you could still smell the fish over the rock, the oils and everything. It was even in the water. We went swimming, you can kind of smell it still. So we moved on to another campsite. And there we found one where the people had left it absolutely clean. What a pleasure that was. It feels good just to be at a place where you have the sense that who was there took care of this place and left it clean for you. But as part of our practice, we pay attention to what we're doing and we see it in the context of the whole. We need to see it in the context of others. When we sit a sesshin, we're not sitting a sesshin for ourselves. We might think so, you might have that attitude, that approach, but really, in reality, you're sitting it with others. And not just the others in the sesshin, but we're always with other. Our whole life is intermingled with others in so many different ways that we could never really parse it out. Only in these artificial ways do we draw the lines and make distinctions. But we so easily lose sight of that and we get into our activity, our little thing, our little number that we're doing, whatever it is that we're having fun with here. And we forget about this larger context in which everything is unfolding. And then we leave traces. We leave something, and sometimes we even intentionally want to do that. We want to leave traces. We will build monuments to ourselves in various ways, hoping that they will last. You know, even putting tombstone and markers where we're buried and that sort of thing. But our way, our practice is actually to move in the other direction. Just never mind those things so much. But pay attention to what you are doing. And to the extent that you are just caught up in for your own momentary pleasure, excitement, whatever the moment is, you know, having fun fishing or whatever, realize that this isn't really how we find a happy life, a satisfying life. We only find that really in the context of others. And we have to be very mindful and attentive to how we're carrying on with others. So this is really a very central to our practice. And this matter of leave no trace, there's so many different ways that this shows up in our teachings and can be expressed in our practice. Suzuki Roshi in Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, he has a section there, a little chapter called No Trace. And in it, even at the little, they pull a caption out of it and put it at the head. And in this particular one, this is the one that was even at the head of that chapter, where he said this to, you know, you live your life in such a way that you just, like a big bonfire, you just burn it through completely, leaving no trace. That when we take up some activity, we do it thoroughly, we do it completely, or don't take it up at all. This would be my teacher, Katagiri Roshi, where he said 0 or 100%. So if we take this up, if you're going to go fishing, you know, into the mountain, whatever it is you're going to do, you're going to take up this practice here, take up the practice of meditation. We take it up wholeheartedly and completely. And this is your life, so take it up for life. Whatever it is you're going to do, you should take it up now for your life. This is the only way to be happy. This is the only way to really find out who you are, and what your real situation is here with others. And in this way, we begin to think less of this petty little self. We just, I don't mean think less in terms of making it smaller, but just we don't frequent that so often. We're not so caught up to the extent that we get ourselves all caught up in our own particular thing, our own having fun or our own problems or one thing or another. We become very narrow, brittle-minded, depressed, confused, frustrated. The real freedom is in the opposite direction of what we think will bring us happiness and contentment. And that is to live in such a way that we completely devour our life, or our life is devoured in the living of it. The burning away completely. In each moment, to live it so thoroughly, there's no need now to go back for anything. No regrets, no remorse, no embarrassment or shame need to be there, because you've burned it up completely in the moment. Of course, it's hard to stay in the moment. That's why we say we have to come back to this again and again and again. We have to wake up again and again. Martine Batchelor, when she was here, she left some books, and in one of her books, she talks about one of her Korean teachers, who talked about, I forget now the circumstance, but it's a matter of shame, anything to be ashamed of. He said, you only have one thing to be ashamed of. One thing to be ashamed of. But you have to be careful with this word shame, because in our culture we don't really understand it very well. We think of it as something very negative. We think it's something, you know, that is kind of putting you down in some way or whatever. That's not really shame. Shame in Buddhism, as we understand it in Buddhism, is there's something in you that prevents you from doing something shameful, like just leaving a mess behind for others without a thought. You know? But he said there's only one thing that you need to be ashamed of, and that is that you have not awakened. That in this moment you are not awake, that you are not here, you are not presently living this thoroughly, burning it up completely in this moment, leaving no trace. That is to be awake in this moment. We come to this practice thinking that I want to be awake, I want to have enlightenment, I will sit this meditation so that I can become enlightened. We think this way. Right now we have the practice period coming up starting next week. Training period actually begins today, but the practice period next week. I get this every year. So I'm not singling out anybody. I hear this over and over. This is like the most common error that we make, and we live with it continuously. I'll even tell you what's wrong with it, and you'll go on to make it again. It is over and over again. It is forgetting the most essential element in meditation practice. Do you know what, does anybody know what that is? What is the most vital thing, huh?
Meditating every day.
Daily. Yeah, not even necessarily daily, but with regularity, that you come back to this again and again on a regular schedule, though. Not haphazardly here and there whenever you feel like it. Something like that. And the practice period that we have is there to just to help us do that. We say, okay, I'll commit to this, and then we do that for 85 days. We have the schedule, we set it up, and now we just do it. That is the most essential thing. Then in practicing in this way, we aren't practicing now with the idea that, you know, I'm putting in my time somehow. I'm putting in my time with the meditation. So when people work out their little schedule, you know, the meditation, they say, well, if I miss a few days here, well, can I make them up over it? But there's no making it up. You know, you don't, this isn't like so many clock hours on the Zafu and you get your credits. It doesn't work that way. We're talking about living your life with quality, with presence, right here, to be here, present in each moment, burning up your life completely in each moment, to learn to come back to this repeatedly. Not just as you're on your cushion sitting in formal meditation, but on a regular basis, that you learn to bring yourself back. And that we do this, we just come back. And this is the point behind this meditation practice, just to do it. And we want to know, what do I do it for? Just to do it. And you say, because I want to be enlightened. Well, what do you think enlightenment is? You don't do this to become enlightened. To be enlightened, to be awake, to be aware, is just that, is to be here, present, awake, aware of what is taking place, both in your surroundings and how you're interacting with others, and also what's going on within your own heart and mind. We're attending to this, you realize this, and when you spin off, when we recognize that, we just come back. It's this continuous practice. The only thing we need to be ashamed of is that we don't do that, he says. And to do this, to come back in this way and to live your life, is just to live your life with no trace, leaving no traces. You don't need to leave anything of yourself behind. I've often talked to my teacher, Katagiri Roshi, in his book, You Have to Say Something, one of my favorite passages, but it speaks to this. I've talked about it before, but let me put it in this context. But he talks about, you say you want to be an artist, he says. He said, basically, two ways to go about this. And the one is that you devote your life to art, and the other is that you work as hard as you can to be the best artist you can. And, of course, most of us will go for that. We want to be the best artist. I want to be an artist. I want to be the best. We'll take that approach. I will take up art now, or whatever else it is, because you want to be the best. You want to... It's you. It's just ego. And it leaves traces. It kind of stinks, like, leaving a mess around is leaving traces of yourself. What this practice is about, what this way is that we follow here is about, and it really is this. You have to understand that it really is this. And we can't play at this. It really is this. To forget yourself, as Katagiri Roshi said, and devote yourself to what if forgetting yourself, you're not even seeing yourself now, and you're just taking up the activity, whatever it is, at 100%, burning yourself up completely in the moment, doing whatever it is. That is our way. That is our practice. That is to leave no trace. And that is how we take up this practice. So how we really, if we take up everything in this way, this is to truly live your life. And as Thoreau says, live your life in such a way so that when you come to the end of it, you don't have any regrets. That you didn't live it, because the only chance you have for living it is now. So burn it up completely in this moment now. This is very, very important to understand, because so quickly we will lapse back into abstraction, into thinking about myself, and I have to do this, and I want to accomplish that, so I get this done. Well, you can do all these things, but forget yourself and what you're getting from this. Just do it. Because to the extent that you pull yourself out of the moment, and you want to gauge it and mark it and categorize it and all the rest of it, see how you're doing, you're not living it. You're living in some kind of abstraction that you get bound to, that fills you with frustration and confusion and depression and anger and envy and all the rest of it. All the unhealthy kinds of emotions, which are there actually as a result of a fragmented mind. A mind in which everything is kind of compartmentalized and separated out. And of course, most of all, there's me here in the middle of all of this. Most of us live out our life in that way, totally absorbed in that way. And we don't actually live. And we don't really understand either. Recently, I got an email from someone who said, this is somebody who lives I guess, far away, but can get my CDs or maybe the talks on the internet, I don't know. And also has read my books. But anyway, this person has been reading my stuff and listening to my talks and came back with some very good questions. Very good questions. By the way, if anybody does want to write me questions, even if they're very good ones, limit them to maybe one. And let me answer that one, then we'll go on. Because sometimes I get pages of questions and I can't deal with that. There's just too many. But anyway, very good questions, this person. I have to answer this person. Very good questions. Just too many, but very, very, very good. That we don't find a self. I was questioning, was if this teaching, if this practice, if what we, our understanding is that we don't find a self here, that our experience is without self, and that if a Buddha experiences without self, and yet they teach, they talk, we have these teachings, things that they've said. This person even noted that the Buddha, when asked, you know, well, what are you? He says, I'm awake. There seems to be a formed self here. How could someone speak without forming a self here? Well, this is important to understand that we actually don't have to, you know, just because there's a body here, just because there's somebody talking here, just because some words were spoken or written down. And I've pointed out that there's no particular one who's awake, no particular person who's awake. We don't find anyone who's enlightened. We don't find anyone, strictly speaking, who's deluded either. But we think we do. And when we hear words spoken, even if they're Dharma words, correct Dharma words, coming from awakening, from enlightenment, and we think, well, that was spoken by so-and-so. Well, strictly speaking, not. Just because somebody is there and speaking, it could be that this person is speaking out of their ego, out of their sense of self, out of a desire that I've got something here and I want to get it across to you. That's not Dharma talk. It doesn't work that way. But it could look just like this. There's somebody here speaking, talking, teaching, somebody here practicing. How can this be done if we don't identify, if we don't form here as a self? This is kind of a confusion. This is a still holding to the sense of self and thinking that it must be this way. But it is very much as what Katagiri was pointing out in that little passage when he said, you know, if you want to be an artist, two ways, you could either just make yourself so it's really about you, even though you might have unselfish motives and whatever. You know, and you really want to devote yourself to this. But you can completely forget about yourself and do it as well. Sometimes people think that this is all about shining, because if I'm not here, if I lose sense of myself, then how can I act? But action is always going on. Action is always taking place. What we are talking about is the quality of your mind. And if the action in your mind is bound up with the self, or if that is constantly being transcended, and I say constantly because we have to do it again and again in each moment. And it is possible to operate in this way, leaving no trace. It is the most, what can I say? I was going to say the most fun way to live, but that's probably, it is not that it's fun or anything, but it is, the Buddha identified it as freedom from dukkha, freedom from suffering, pain, confusion. Freedom from confusion, meaning that there isn't something here that you don't understand about reality, about life, about living your life. Many things we don't understand about this and that and one thing or another. Yeah, but in the overall picture, everything is quite clear. For most of us, we're caught up with the this and that, and we keep trying to clarify everything amongst all the little different things that are occurring here. And we try to maintain ourselves in these little pockets of clarity, feeling threatened, you know, and confused every once in a while when it bumps up against some reality that doesn't quite fit within this little narrow place that we've made for ourselves. And that's occurring because the overall picture isn't clear. The overall picture is in darkness and confusion. And that is occurring to us because we have withdrawn ourselves into this little confined, separated ego self here. And now we try to operate in such a way to please that. Well, you can't please this self. Don't even try. It will never be pleased. It pleased momentarily, and then it's wanting again. So that isn't even our concern. For one who's awake, there's no concern for that whatsoever. And this is freedom from this kind of pain, confusion. It is awakening to the whole. For one who is awake, what they see, what their concern is with the whole. And not with the part. It's with the field. And not the particle, not the separated thing. Now, of course, within this field, all the little different individuated things, the particles, they all show up. Yeah, but now you can take care of them, though, because you see the whole. But you see it in such a way that nothing is leaving any trace. And you are not leaving any trace because you're not dragging that with you. This sense of self, dragging it into everything. Contrary to what we think, that you know, we want to please ourselves, we want to feel protected and wanted and needed and have some value here. No, just forget all of that, because you'll never find that. It can't be done. You'll never be pleased in that way. We turn our attention away from that, this whole problem, this issue of wanting to be pleased and happy and all that, it's gone. And along with it, all confusion. And this is leaving no trace. Well, maybe I've gone on a bit here. Do you have any questions about anything I said now today? Yes?
After you've given, it seems like it could be an introductory talk for a whole series of talks.
Oh, yeah. This is good, yeah.
So I was wondering that the way to live fully must be to select certain mental states and let go of other mental states, because there are some mental states that leave enormous residue. Like if I'm experiencing grasping, to practice your Dharma talk wouldn't be to grasp fully, because that leaves so much residue.
Yeah, but see, that's you grasping, you see. Now, this isn't about grasping. This is about just simply noting what you're doing. That's being awake. So the grasping doesn't even need to take place. And with that, then you'd understand everything that I've said. But with the grasping, now things start to shut down again. And it isn't even a matter of even picking and choosing. Like you want to choose certain mental states and reject others. We think we can do that. But that's just continuing our confusion. But you can't choose really to be awake as such. Just wake up. We don't choose to be awake. We just wake up. We don't really choose to be deluded either, you know. But we can notice how it is that we are deluded by noticing our grasping mind. And now we've just awakened to that. So it isn't a matter of choosing something. To choose something then is to objectify something. You've just created self, see, and you've separated it now from something that I want to get. So we don't choose. In the Xinqing Ming, the classic Zen text, he says, picking and choosing is the mind's worst disease. And the disease meaning the dis-ease of the mind. The mind is ill at ease because it is choosing, it is picking. That in itself is the perpetuation of the self, of ego. And it could be very subtle, but that's what it is. It's still going on, you see. So we just recognize all this is then is just, you don't even really have to remember what I said or notice what I said, but possibly in a talk like this, it might help you to just notice what you're doing now. And that's the point, not to grasp the talk or to get some idea out of it, but just to wake up to what you're doing. It's very simple what this is. In a sense, we can get rid of all these talks altogether, you know. But still, as my teacher said, if you don't point these things out, well. So we do need to listen to this, but then in the end, don't grasp it. Just start noticing what you're doing. And of course, we're back to grasping again, but we can learn to come back to that. At some point, if we really learn to be present here, we can actually wake up. Well, I say we can wake up, but actually in the waking up, there's no one waking up. But that's waking up. Now that's truly to be present in this moment. But who's present? Well, you can't say. Of course, we've never been able to say all along, even though we think we can. Most of us will settle for, well, I'm present. Well, yeah, but what's that? Yeah.
Did the Buddha leave any traces?
You mean like the Buddha's relics and things? Traces of the Buddha. Yeah, the teachings. Well, you see, speaking of Buddha relics, we have people that will worship things like, well, they have, in some cases, like the bones, the ashes, the hair of the Buddha, you know. These are relics. You know, and then some people worship these things. And some people, we have the bowl that he carried, maybe some of his robes, I don't know. Also, they have footprints, apparently, you know. Kind of like, you know, remember Dinosaur National Park? I follow these big dinosaur footprints. You ever been there? There's one place where they go right into a cliff. Of course, the cliff wasn't there when the dinosaur was. Why was it muddy? But it was just rock now, you see. So I'm picturing these footprints of the Buddha in something that's turned to stone. I don't know if there's been enough time for that to happen, though. But they have these things, these footprints of the Buddha and other kinds of things like that. And these are called the relics. And, of course, there's people buying and trading and selling in these relics, too. Probably it's kind of a black market, perhaps. You know, you have to question, are these really, is this really Buddha's hair here? But people get caught by that. That's the part. That's the particular, the thing that can be grasped. No, you can't grasp the Buddha that way. There's very simplistic kind of thinking. Because even if the Buddha were right here in the flesh, we still can't get hold of the Buddha. Because there's no particular thing that's the Buddha. We've looked at this before. Like our bodies, they don't stand still for a moment, coming and going constantly. All the material of our body now was not in our body a few months ago, and a few months from now it'll all be gone, replaced by other material. You know, the actual atoms and molecules of our bodies are constantly coming and going. So what is this holding? Is this the Buddha? What does that even mean? But we will go for that thing that we can grasp. And then, of course, you ask about the teachings. Well, what about these mental objects then that the Buddha spoke? And said, well, we don't really know what the Buddha said. It was never written down. Not at that time. Of course, it was written down later. And people had a remarkable ability at that time, because this was the tradition, to memorize and to, you know, spew back what the Buddha said. But to what degree is this correct? And no, we don't know. To what degree has culture and stories and myths and you know, all the kinds of folklore and whatever else get entwined into all that? We don't know. Pretty hard to sort that out. So what are the traces of the Buddha? Well, we could say, well, there's just Buddhism. And on the face of the earth today, hundreds of millions of people practicing in one form or another. Buddhism came from the Buddha. Aren't these traces? Well, yeah, sure. But it's always our grasping mind that is looking for that thing that it can get hold of. And what the Buddha was interested in was getting us to notice our experience now. And never mind, we can appreciate the fact that was there someone like this who walked the earth at one time, left these, I think so, probably. You know, that seems quite likely. I don't even want to hang on to that so tightly. But we have these incredible teachings now. A lot of them are interspersed with all kinds of nonsense and goofiness, you know. Now, some of it is quite profound and subtle. We should appreciate it, all of it, really. Because all of it shows us something about human life and our time and place here.
The teachings are designed to erase the traces.
Teachings on what?
The teachings are designed to erase the traces.
That's exactly right. Yeah, that's how the Buddha taught. The Buddha taught in such a way so as to erase his own teaching, yeah? Liking it to a raft, yeah, that sort of thing. You know, that we leave behind. So are there traces of the Buddha? You know, what the Buddha said, though, finally, was he said, if you want to see me, and he says, see the Dharma. In other words, what he's saying, if you want to see me, you know, don't look for the relics, don't look for the teachings, don't look for the things that you can grasp and hold on to and believe in and that sort of thing. Just wake up. See the Dharma. Wake up to reality. This is what the Buddha said, supposedly. As I said, we don't know for sure what he said, but it all seems to fit with this kind of teaching. So nothing to hold on to here. We don't need to be afraid of that. We're afraid of that because to the extent we're holding to a self, we have to hold on to something. Something needs to support me, you know, and sustain me. So we hang on to one thing or another. But actually not. The whole universe sustains and supports just this. Here we are. So you don't need to, don't worry about that. Just wake up. So you don't need to grasp the Buddha or do we have the right teachings here? You know, another thing too, like, you know, the Buddha is not a savior. The Buddha is not a messenger of God, something like this. Buddha is just a human being. But a human being is awake. That's all. And so that we don't even really know for sure exactly what did the Buddha say or did the Buddha even live. This doesn't even really matter. We have these incredible teachings and this way of helping ourselves just to wake up. That's the point. In other cases where you have a religious leader like that, who's a messiah or whatever, then you have to believe that person. And you know, that's so important. That's so central. That's the whole crux of the whole thing. You know, the linchpin. Buddhism has nothing like that, really. Though because we're human beings, people will grasp. As I said, there's people that will worship these relics, you know. And where they can even create a black market in relics. You know, because people are grasping. But it's human delusion. But Buddhism will help us to notice that even about Buddhism, how it's mistreated and misunderstood. So again, for each one of us, then it just comes back right here to what you're doing, what is taking place right now in your own heart and mind. That's really all this is in the end. And the rest of it, we can get rid of it. Well, I don't know, get rid of it. We can't get rid of anything. But we can at least not misuse it and respect it and appreciate it, even the delusional stuff. Frustrating as it is for me to kind of keep trying to set this aside, I have to appreciate it that it's there. That too tells us something of reality and Dharma and of human beings and how we are, how grasping we are, how wanting we are to get something. But recognize the ego, the ego's work, it's just like that. And this, what the Buddha spoke of, the freedom that he spoke of is freedom from that. Now, how do we find that freedom? That freedom is found within your own heart and mind right now in this moment. That's the only way. And it doesn't involve words and saying something and get a hold of this. None of that. But it gives the clarity in which to see all of these things taking place so we're not confused by any of it or taken in by any of it. Nor do we reject any of it in the sense of this has got to be destroyed, gotten rid of. We don't treat it in that way at all. Even as this delusional teaching, okay. This is delusional teaching. It's wonderful delusional teaching. You know, appreciate it and know it for what it is. That's all. Anything else? Oh, yeah. Well, I don't know if anybody can do it, but if you mean 100%, like moment after moment. I don't know that that's possible, that someone could just live continuously in awakening. Well, in a sense, we already do. But our mind is always constructing stuff, and we'll reconstruct the self very quickly, momentarily. But we can learn to just not be so quickly caught by that. Can we function in Western society with that? Yeah, I think so. Though to the degree that you really live out of that, you'll probably be a real source of confusion for a lot of other people. So you have to be careful, you know, with other people and kind of go along with their delusional ways to a point. Because if you don't, they'll think you're crazy. You know, they'll lock you up and put you away. Yes?
Well, it comes no surprise to you that I haven't agreed much with you today.
Well, you never do.
Yeah. For obvious reasons. It seems sapiens is squatted on this planet like a festering boil on the acid alley. Now, how on earth can you talk to her? You speak in these Pollyanna terms of leave no trace. My gosh, we've got open pit minds.
Yeah.
As a species, we are trace. Even being born is a trace.
Right. We do leave traces. That's what I was saying. We do leave traces. This was the point I was making. Maybe I didn't make it clear. It's because it's a very subtle point, I'm afraid, but the fellow who wrote to me, or the person that wrote to me and asked about this, well, how can one speak the truth or live out of this awakening and speak out of this awakening, act out of this awakening, practice out of this awakening without forming a self? The moment a self is formed here, of course, it leaves traces. The very fact that we have a body, it's going to leave traces of some kind. The very fact that we say things or write anything down, it's leaving traces. Of course, this is true. But what I'm speaking of, the enlightened mind is not of that sort. It doesn't leave traces. You can't get hold of it. And the mass of humanity leaves traces all over the place. Yes, indeed, I would say the mass of humanity also doesn't live out of enlightenment. But even if all of us did live out of enlightenment in this moment, the very fact that we're physical beings, we are going to leave physical traces, of course. This is the nature of real. So I wasn't speaking of that. I'm speaking of that in the moment that we act and speak out of awakening, it doesn't leave any trace. There's no residue there because there's no self there that's offering it. It's not coming from particularness. It's coming out of wholeness and going back into wholeness, and it doesn't leave any trace. To the extent that we say, well, that's just a person sitting there talking, yeah, well, then it appears to be leaving traces. But where are these traces? Are they in your mind? Are they in the mind of the person who's talking? They could be. But it depends on whether that person in this moment is awake or not. What I'm pointing out is to the extent that in this moment one speaks out of awakening, there are no traces. And it shows up in various ways, like not attachment to what you just said or anything of that sort, you know. In all kinds of ways that can be pointed to. Yes?
I'm trying to get my hands around our talk about leaving a trace, because it feels as if leaving a trace is a negative thing, when in fact,
that's
when
a natural
we are
thing, isn't it?
Selfless, mm-hmm, or serve, we leave a trace of love or connection, mm-hmm, which is a very beautiful thing.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Yeah, many traces are very beautiful. Yeah. Even the selfless artist who does devote their life to art and then create wonderful art, leaving beautiful traces behind to inspire many people for generations to come.
But the way is to not leave a trace.
Yeah, this is very important to understand that, see, we'll constantly put everything that we hear into dualistic terms. And so if I offer a description of what the enlightened mind is like, that it leave in the sense of leaving no trace, then we think, ah, that is good. And then leaving traces is bad. But I don't think I said that. I even said that the delusional stuff is beautiful and wonderful. We can't get rid of it. We shouldn't hate it. We have all kinds of teachings here that tell us, don't hate the world of the six dusts, you know, and that sort of thing. Not hating this is synonymous with enlightenment, with awakening. Not loving enlightenment is also synonymous with enlightenment, you know. Because that's just grasping again, you see. And that's not really enlightenment. This is just simply flatly pointing out what is, you know, how it is. And to the extent that something is showing up here, then we have traces. We have a world of cause and effect. We have a world of this and that. We have a world of a Zen center and a floor and a place. And here I am talking and you're here listening. And all this kind of stuff is happening. This is not something we need to hate or something that we need to think is bad. That's just our usual dualistic way of thinking. But within this context, within this whole, it is possible to awaken. And to the extent that there's this action, speech, whatever's taking place out of awakening, there's no trace. There's nothing that's offering that. There's nothing that's presenting that. And if we hear without that, we hear leaving no trace as well. And it is just like as Suzuki Roshi said, and again in Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, where he said that when my talking is through, your listening is through, there's no need to remember what I said.
because it is all taking place in this moment, and in this moment where we're truly here in this moment, we will, it will be there, what he said. In this moment when it needs to come forth, there it is. So we don't need to grasp or to hang on, or even to think about this. Some of you now might be taking the Nagarjuna series that's coming up. If you've gone through the first year classes, you're welcome to, you know, to join us in next week, I guess, yeah, starts. Long series of classes goes on for the whole year. But this is a class that is very difficult if we approach it in our usual way. And we're trying to figure it out, to think, what's Nagarjuna getting at here? What's his point? What traces is he leaving here for me to grasp? Well, the difficulty of Nagarjuna, more than any other teaching that I know in this literature, leaves no trace. There is nothing there that you can get hold of in Nagarjuna. And we find that very difficult because we keep looking for something and he keeps undoing everything that we might grasp, you know, and we start to get kind of frustrated with this until we begin to catch on. There's something else going on here that we normally miss. And it is taking place outside this ordinary world of dualism that we're caught up in, where we go to one extreme or the other. And there's a way of speaking and teaching that doesn't leave any residue, and there's nothing left for you to get. I've studied Nagarjuna now for over 30 years now. In a sense, after all that study, and I've taught it now many times, there's nothing. You say, well, what's in the end, what is it? There's really nothing there. Of course, then we think, well, then what's the point of any of this? But the point of it is, through this study, through what he will point out to you, he keeps pointing out our delusion and our confusion and our grasping. Until at some point we recognize it ourselves. We realize directly for ourselves what is taking place here. And then we can live without grasping. And that's, once again, leaving no trace. Momentarily, we'll all slip. I don't know anybody who can stay on the beam perfectly. I certainly can't. But we can learn. We can first start to realize that there is this possibility. And then maybe at some point we can actually see it for the first time. And then we can learn to just bring ourselves back to that, to stay with that. That's all this really is. And then in the end, they can set all the teachings aside. As the Buddha said, it's just like a raft. Leave it by the river. Just set it all aside. Were this something that we need the traces of, he wouldn't have said that. But he points that out for that very reason, so we can be free of it. Otherwise, the teaching itself becomes a chain. Okay, so did that answer? Maybe I should stop. Was there a vital, burning question? Okay, thank you.
Thank you for listening. To hear more talks on Buddhism, Zen, and related topics, visit dharmafield.org. Buddhism, Zen, and related topics, visit dharmafield.org.